On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, I welcome in two special guests. It is Eric Longenhagen of Fangraphs will guest host with me to talk about the signings of Kazuma Okamoto and Tatsuya Imai, as well as cover the baseball implications of what is happening in Venezuela and a couple other topics. I will also welcome in Chandler Rome of The Athletic, Astros beat writer, to tell us some of the ins and outs of the Tatsuya Imai signing and why it is a significant move for the Astros franchise. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that thinks Tatsuya Imai should make his major league debut wearing grills. I'm Jordan Schusterman, not joined by Jake Mintz, who is on vacation, but my guest co-host today is Eric Longenhagen, the lead prospect analyst from Fangraphs. And Eric, my friend, did you see Tatsuya Imai just bouncing around H-Town?
I saw a little bit of it. I saw what you sent me. Being a largely offline person, some of that stuff just eludes me naturally, but when another sport is involved, and I like some of those Rockets player. I'm a big Amen Thompson guy. I definitely saw the very clean sweatsuit look, which is like a thing that I'm more putting together for myself as I go out in the world recently, where it's just like, yeah, why don't I just got like monochrome brown, Catasaqua sweatshirt and homage sweatpants. And like, that is absolutely what I'm going into the world with. So I feel you, Imai, very much.
Yes. A little bit of a different, I would say prestige than the Boris Korp logo, but still something that I think you can relate to. Yes, we will have a good amount of Tatsuya Imai conversation on this podcast, including you will hear my conversation with Chandler Rome later on in the show, the Astros beat writer for The Athletic. But we are going to talk about Tatsuya Imai, who was at the Texans game. He was right behind Kevin Durant making a game-winning shot. But most notably, if you're confused by my intro, Paul Wall has already tweeted about Tatsuya Imai. So that is very exciting for the city of Houston. But Eric, you are here to join me to talk about quite the wide range of topics. The first part of this podcast, we are going to talk about, of course, the big signings of Tatsuya Imai, but also Kazuma Okamoto, who joined the Toronto Blue Jays. Then you'll hear my conversation with Chandler. And then later on, we are going to talk about the baseball ramifications of what is happening currently in Venezuela, which is, of course, a much heavier topic than we are normally going to tackle, but it is something that would be disingenuous to not cover as people who talk about the sport of baseball. So we will get to all that later, but let's get to our opener. We do have some signings. All right, Eric. It's been a while since we had you on here on the show, but you, as someone who evaluates amateur prospects for the most part, but also minor league prospects, players who are not yet major league players, you do have a good perspective on the players who are coming over from NPB, because it is a similar assignment, which is, are these players going to be good major leaguers? Obviously, that is what you are often trying to forecast. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. That's roughly what you are attempting in your job when you are writing about prospects, right? Is their prospects, are they going to be good major leaguers? But because they're coming over from foreign leagues, it is a different kind of assignment. They're often older. There is more data, but data that is complicated by the competition level and other contextual factors. So let's begin with Kazuma Okamoto, the corner infielder who has agreed to a deal with the Toronto Blue Jays for 4 years and $60 million. Just a little bit of biographical background on this player. This is someone who has been essentially the face or one of the faces of the Yomiuri Giants for the last half decade. The Giants, the most historically successful franchise in NPB with the most championships, although like the New York Yankees, they have not won in quite some time. I believe 2012 was their most recent title, so before Okamoto's time. But Okamoto has been one of the best hitters in Japan for the last half decade, and really the last couple years has elevated his game to a point where it's like, okay, we're seeing someone that could be a really good, impactful major league hitter, and whispers about the possibilities of him coming to MLB really started to grow. But I will say the other important historical nugget here relevant to his NPB team is that not every NPB team is comfortable with posting their players. There have been more teams that are more reluctant to letting their players come to MLB than others. Of course, there have been much more ease of that restriction recently. The Omiyori Giants, I believe, have never posted a position player to come to MLB, but Okamoto, for whatever contextual reasons, was, you know, given that opportunity, and now he is a Toronto Blue Jay. So before we talk about his fit on Toronto, like, what do you see in this guy? Like, what kind of player is he? I don't need to give me comps, but what does he do well that gives you confidence that he can be a good major league player?
Well, I mean, he hits. You know, this is a player where the degree of confidence in the hit tool in like a binary sense was greater than, you know, certainly this offseason, what I felt about Munetaka Murakami, where sometimes player, you know, position players just hit so little that they are just a binary no, like this will not work. You're not going to make enough contact to be relevant in any kind of way. Anytime we're talking about players coming over from Japan, you know, they're at risk of doing that. There's just not a way to replicate the MLB stuff environment anywhere else in the world, be it, you know, in NPB, which is an excellent league, or at AAA. There's just, you know, not as much fastball velocity there. And like in Okamoto's case, you know, one of the first things that you're looking at over the course of the last couple of years is how has he performed against premium velocity? And even in like a 3-year sample, there are only 350 pitches or so that he faced, you know, 94 miles an hour and above. That's like, you know, a couple of months worth of big league fastballs. So there's volatility inherent in all of that because the sample size is so small. But in that sample, he performed really well. Like we're talking about, you know, mid to upper 80s contact rate against those fastballs. And so insofar as like you can be confident that this guy is going to hit big league pitching, and when you're diving deep and trying to ascertain whether like the specific problem that plagues guys like, you know, Yoshitomo Tsutsugo and, you know, some of the guys who have come over here, even though they've had success in Japan and not really done anything, you know, Okamoto checks that box as much as he can. So it's more a balanced skill set for this guy, who I think is, you know, he's going to hit in that 5-6 hole in a good lineup. And I think that's exactly where he fits in with the Jays.
I think defensively, let's save that part of the conversation because that is most relevant for how he fits with Toronto, because there's a lot of interesting questions involving that. But keeping the focus on him as a hitter, I think another thing that, you know, reading your reports at all levels that I always appreciate is explaining not just like, okay, this data tells me that this guy sucks against curveballs, but it's like explaining why. What is he physically doing that is not going to work against this type kind of pitch? We don't have to get too technical here, but is there something you've seen with Okamoto, like just why his swing works, why his swing functions? I know you wrote, I believe in your write-up for Fangraphs this past weekend about how he's also improved when you watch his highlights or you look at his spray charts. He's just been on time more for fastballs. He's been pulling stuff more. He's been hitting velocity. He's been able to produce slug to the opposite field as well in a way that earlier on in his career, it was just, you know, hitting breaking balls, which velocity wise, much going to be easier to pull. I also think that another part of the NPB equation that I'm so super interested in, especially when you bring Murakami back into the conversation, is the era of offense in Japan, which is currently what is essentially, I'm describing it as the opposite of what we had in MLB from 2017 to 2019, where offense, and now I will say it's a little bit different because our juiced ball era in 2017-2019 was really more about home runs as much as it was offense in general. Whereas in Japan right now, not only are home runs hard to come by, just offense. I mean, you just look at the ERAs, like we'll get to Imai's numbers in a second. A 2 ERA right now in Japan is kind of a 3 ERA, right? Like your 1.94 really is a 2.94, like because of how bad the offensive environment is. I say all that to say Okamoto and Murakami have still been able to produce slugging in a way that essentially no very, very few other hitters in that league have over the past few years. So what is it about him that you see that he's physically able to do that?
Yeah, he's just like a short levered guy who's geared to pull. And yeah, Okamoto's been on, you know, I've had Okamoto report on Fangraphs that's been updated each offseason for I think like the last 3 or 4 years, because it has been, you know, a while now when this guy, like, you know, has been producing at an elite level for that league. And yeah, my notes from prior years were, hey, like this guy's struggling with elevated fastballs and like he's mostly a mistake breaking ball hitter, at least as far as him you know, accessing his power is concerned. But like, you know, when your spray chart looks like this does, it's not quite in that like ESOC Paredes area where so much of the contact is like right down the left field line, but it does kind of look like that. And it has more and more over the last 2 to 3 years been shifting toward that. And when you isolate the look against fastballs, that stays true. There are lots of hitters where you look at the spray chart as a whole and it's pretty balanced. And then when you isolate by pitch type, it's, oh, you can pull breaking balls, but like really not do that against fastballs. And if we're talking about a high school hitter, if we're talking about, you know, a college hitter or someone in the low minors for whom that's true, well, that might be like a yellow or red flag to me, because if you can't pull 90 mile an hour fastballs, what are you going to do when they're 94, 95? But in Okamoto's case, like, he's just a short levered hitter who, you know, that body's opening up toward the third base side enough that sometimes he's making sacrifices against well-located sliders away from him because he's just so geared to pull, but it's working for him. And, you know, it's a big driver for accessing your power when you don't have, you know, Okamoto's got more like average, above average power. It's not ridiculous, like light tower plus plus raw. But you know, when you're executing an approach like this, you're going to get to all of that power in games and produce at a level that I think is like going to be pretty good for, you know, a below average defender at third base.
Yes. And we're going to get to that here in a second, but I'm glad you mentioned that. And that's why, you know, if you read prospect reports at Fangraphs, you see raw power and you see game power. The likelihood that players are going to be able to access that in Okamoto's case, you know, for Murakami, that we are talking about, you know, freak show hitting the ball as hard as almost anybody on earth. And that is why you can strike out that often and still produce, because the likelihood that when you do hit the ball, something good's going to happen is just so high, right? And that's really what we have seen with Murakami. Now, in his case, he was also drawing a lot more walks. I think with Okamoto, again, you just talk about all the splits, maybe sure against velocity, but even moving that aside because the sample's so small, you just look at the end zone contact rate, even if you accept that the competition level is lower, it's just way more encouraging. And when you compare it to some of the other MPB hitters that have come over, whether it's a Suzuki or even an Otani or Yoshida, like, he's right up there. And the fact that he just posted essentially his best season of his career from a contact standpoint, even in a smaller sample size because he was hurt, I think all of that contributes to a lot of confidence. But let's talk about him as a defender, because that's really what's relevant for him on the Blue Jays roster. Obviously, this Blue Jays offseason is far from finished, as it seems that they are still heavily involved in maybe bringing back Bichette, bringing in Kyle Tucker. You know, you see a range of defense. First of all, like Blue Jays, oh my God. I mean, let's actually pause here, right? Can we just pause and just marvel at the Toronto Blue Jays, who have now spent over $300 million this offseason? You can get rid of, here's the way I put it in my story, remove Dylan Cease, and they're the third highest spending team in free agency this year, right? So wow. A lot of offseason left. There's other guys to be spent. But if we get a Kyle Tucker contract, a Bichette contract, who knows? You know, we could be looking at $500 million spent this offseason. And that's after they just gave $500 million to Vlad Jr. So what a time to be a Blue Jays fan, of course. There's so many interesting parts about just their status as a franchise. But when you look at this roster fit, you wrote about it a little bit. The way I described it is that, like, the versatility, but also the weaknesses of the players that are currently in house are why Okamoto is a good fit, right? You have guys that can move around, but you also have a lot of lefties that can't hit lefties at all. And you also have some guys that, you know, you maybe want to not be hitting at the very middle of your order, at the top of your order. I love Ernie Clement as much as the next person. I don't know if, you know, counting on him to hit 400 for the entirety of the regular season moving forward. And even Addison Barger, there's some volatility there. So that's why I see Okamoto being a good fit. To me, it is clearly a vote of confidence that he can handle third base, right? I mean, we know he's not playing first base with Vlad Jr. there. We know DH is not available. This would seem to be a pretty big saying that, like, yeah, like, you're going to be our third baseman, and we're going to live with that because we think you can really raise the floor and maybe ceiling of our offense.
I think that's right. And I think some of what we know about Toronto and some of what we know about baseball in general, I mean, like the Dodgers have won consecutive World Series with Max Muncy playing third base. Mm-hmm. And there's some stuff Muncy does over there that is quite impressive. And then he's limited, you know, his mobility and his range are limited. Some of those dribblers in on the grass that good defenders turn into outs. Like, those are singles against Max Muncy. And Okamoto is pretty similar defender where, like, his actions in short area are impressive. Like, he goes to the ground and can spin and make some of these nice throws. But like he's a huskier, slower guy who's, you know, got below average range and is limited in other ways. Toronto, like, look, like Ernie Clement's limited in some ways. Ernie Clement can't throw really, you know, and you know, going to his backhand, he's not especially good. And still, like, it's okay. Like, he does enough other stuff. His hands are good. His range is good. Like, that on balance, it's fine. And I think that, like, if we've learned anything about Toronto over the last couple of years, it's that they are willing to live with Davis Schneider playing second and third base in left field, and let's move these guys around. And Addison Barger's a flawed third baseman, but he's got a cannon, so let's do it. Bo Bichette.
Just posted a horrible, and it's also funny because you still sort by OAA and DRS, and it's like, well, they're still ranking highly, and that's because Alejandro Kirk and Dalton Varsho are like balling out in the and Jimenez, right? They've like surrounded their three Gold Glover caliber players with not that, which is a really interesting roster construction.
So I think, you know, and Okamoto's got experience in left field, and in doing the evaluation in a vacuum, I was just like, come on, like, this guy's not going to do that in the big leagues, right? But now that he's in Toronto, I wouldn't rule it out necessarily. There are just some days when, why not have Vladdy take a day off and DH this day and Okamoto can play first, or you want Anthony Santander to have a day off? Well, just throw Okamoto in left field one day. And like, you know, if there's a team that's going to like this player the most, it's because they feel positive about what he can do at third base. Like, part of the reason the Blue Jays maybe liked Okamoto the most enough to pay him what they did and get a deal done is because, hey, we do think he can play third base, and hey, we do think he can move around defensively. So it just stands to reason that, you know, based on what Toronto has been like the last couple of years, that they might be the one who says, you know, we're going to actually let this guy, you know, flesh it out on defense a little bit more. And rather than just stand at third base every day and be a four there, you know, we can actually move him around. And I think this is one of the teams more likely to actually try that. And, you know, you mentioned Santander. I really think that the only reason this team had a chance to win the World Series was this lineup's deep. Like, everyone's dangerous in a way. I really like Ernie Clement as a hitter. I just think that his bat-to-ball skills are enough that he is a threat to put the ball in play well every time he's at the dish. Doesn't matter. You execute against him, doesn't matter. Still put the barrel there. And Okamoto, you know, George Springer's old, and Anthony Santander was hurt, and some of this stuff is definitely up in the air. I think adding this guy protects the depth piece of their, you know, protects the depth piece of the lineup rather than like adding a Kyle Tucker, like, oh my gosh, if they were to do that. But like the depth part of it is protected now because of this guy's versatility. So if something happens to Springer, something happens to Santander, they just go belly up or whatever it is from age or injury or whatever, this guy's versatility helps protect you against that.
Yeah, well said. However, if you're a Jays fan listening to this, like, you're clearly still thinking about a Bichette reunion, thinking about Tucker, how that would all work out. I think the other thing about Ernie is it's like, yes, I totally hear you. Has earned the ability to like be a regular player on a good team. Is Ernie Clement at second base blocking Bo Bichette from returning? Like, that feels like a bit of a stretch. If Ernie Clement's the first guy off your bench, your roster's probably in pretty good shape. You know, that's another way to look at it. But either way, it seems like Okamoto, they decided and clearly had the financial wherewithal to maybe give him the fourth year that no one else was giving him, right? Like, what exactly got this deal done from that perspective? I don't think we totally know yet. I know his introductory press conference is actually today, so we'll hear from him and Boris in Toronto today. But I think that it's also really important to your point that they could view him as a third baseman, because that just impacts so much of what you're willing to pay for really any player, I think. And, you know, with the exceptions, you know, they just paid their first baseman $500 million, but that's a little bit of a different circumstance. And I think with Okamoto, it really lined up well for him to be an ideal fit there. So I'm excited about that. As for whether that contract is a we're going to get back to that. Scobo coming up here in a second. But let's go to Houston. Let's talk about Tetsuya Imai. You're going to hear my conversation with Chandler Rome here in a second. So, like, his fit with Houston, a lot of Astros-related specific things we can move to the side. But let's just talk about Imai as a pitcher. This contract, 3 years, $54 million, guaranteed, could get up to $63 million with some innings-based incentives. But opt-outs after each of the first 2 years. So if he's awesome, this is probably a one-year deal. It seems, based on the projections, that Imai also, like Murakami, undershot the projections pretty significantly. What do you think were maybe the hesitations from teams in committing long-term to Imai, even though he is much younger than the average free agent pitcher? And then also, what are reasons to be excited?
Yeah, I think if there's an aspect of the, like, the volatility inherent in the NPB pitcher is, does the chase environment in NPB mask bad command? Imai, over the course of the last couple of years, has improved as a strike thrower on paper. You know, early portion of his career, he was pretty wild, walking a lot of batters. And then really over the last 2 to 3 years, has improved substantially to the point where, like, if you just buy that he's going to be the guy he was in Japan, like, there are no concerns about this. But the base chase rate in NPB is 4 percentage points higher than it is in Major League Baseball. It's like 32% chase is the average in NPB versus 28% in, you know, MLB. And that's before, like, we were adjusting for stuff quality and, you know, before we're isolating some of the velocity stuff. And for Tatsuya Imai, who throws really hard compared to, you know, the average NPB starter, especially, you know, is some of poor command being masked by the propensity of hitters in NPB to chase more? Like, it's feasible. And anytime we're talking about a guy whose best pitch is a breaking ball, some of the subtle variations in the baseball itself start to come into play. You know, the seams are a little different. The tackiness is a little bit different. Does that have an impact on your breaking ball quality when you come over here? Do you have to make an adjustment mechanically or with your, or whatever it is, like, that creates volatility around, and in Imai's case, his best pitch, his slider. So, you know, and there are mechanical markers here that, you know, we're just watching a pitcher that indicate this might be someone who struggles with fastball command. This is when you freeze frame Tatsuya Imai's delivery when that front foot lands, his arm is a little bit late a lot of the time. And that's a marker of a player whose fastballs sail up and arm side on him. So you're going to have that issue over here. So when you're starting to pick nits, these are some of the things that come up for Imai. But in general, like, my evaluation was very favorable. This is a guy whose stuff is good enough that, you guys talk about this on the pod a lot. Do you want to hand the ball to this guy in a playoff series? Is he a lock to be in your rotation in the playoffs? Or is he Taiwan Walker? Is he, you know, Jose Quintana, where it's sort of on
the
fringe?
Is he the game four, like,
Right. And to me, he's over that line where the quality of his stuff,
if it works,
is such that, yes,
if it works, he's, yep.
He fits. So, and then, like, athletically, holy cow, like, mechanically, this guy
you
is super
that.
Loose. Yeah, he's explosive. Is there another gear to his changeup still? Like, there are other positive projection indicators as well. So, I was an Imai fan. I have a 50 on him, which is, like, right there. That's that number four starter on a contender. You feel good about, you know, 7-game playoff series. You give the ball to this guy in game four. That feels all right. And I thought, yeah, this was way the Murakami stuff didn't necessarily surprise me because I've been apprehensive for a little bit. And again, it's just like in a binary place where, do you think this guy's Joey Gallo now, where it's like a 65% contact rate and below? Well, it doesn't really matter how much power
he
has.
If he succeeds, he will be defying a lot of history, is really just the way to look at it. And I've been the high guy Murakami, just arguing that young enough to make the adjustments just because, like, we don't really know what he can do until he's actually tested against, and the upside is still something that is so tantalizing. But I get it. It is much more black and white of, like, this is so extreme. Whereas with Imai, as you just mentioned, a little more subtle. Some of the nuances, there's still a lot to kind of fall back on as something to feel comfortable about paying him. That said, clearly not enough for him to get a deal that would likely price him out of being an Astro, as we'll talk about with Chandler. Like, the Astros, sure, as much as they maybe wanted to make a dent and start signing Asian players and whatever, if he was getting the deal he was projected for, he wasn't going to be an Astro. They weren't giving this guy $150 million. It all worked out for that to be the case. But I think, and then also add in, by the way, we talk about the transition. The first thing ever brings up is, right, you know, one fewer day of rest. I think that that's something that clearly teams have found a way to manage to kind of massage throughout the season with the fact that in MPB you're really starting usually once a week as opposed to the traditional, you know, five-man rotation that we see in MLB. But there's just so much fluidity. It's just like there's so few teams nowadays that are really, you know, guys are actually taking the ball every 5 days. Like that's not right. actually something that's happening as often as it used to. And so there's clearly some flexibility there. But I'm excited to see what he can do. And obviously Houston has a great reputation with just like all kinds of pitchers, guys that have huge stuff like Hunter Brown, guys that you can't believe are throwing major league games all the time like Jason Alexander, right? Like they are finding ways for guys to get outs. They have done that as well as almost any other team in the league. I think that's another reason to round up on Imai when you look at his landing spot. Now, all that said, I think we should have a conversation about these contracts. It is time for a very important update for the Scobo Scobo. The Scott Boras scoreboard, where all offseason long we are giving Scott Boras super agent wins, losses, and draws, depending on where his clients sign, his terrible puns at the winter meetings, and everything in between. We have a few things for evaluation today. First and foremost, these two contracts. Let's begin with Kazuma Okamoto. If you compare it to the projections, 4 years, $60 million for Okamoto is really close. I mean, I believe MLB Trade Rumors had 4 years, 64, I think they had for him. Maybe it's a little bit lower than what some of the other projections had. But if you're from a Scott Boras perspective, you know, trying to get my client the most amount of money, what do we think about this one, about Okamoto? Is this like, damn, you did well? Damn, how'd you not get him $100 million? Or is this, it's a draw, you kind of held serve? What do you think?
I'll give him a win for this one. I think the fact that I think part of the skill set required here was just getting the Giants to post the position player, like you said. I also think that some of our expectations in the public sphere, when there were only a handful of us projecting the player or projecting the contract, there's going to be volatility. There's going to be, you know, the rate of human errors is going to be what it is. And I'm not sure that we're great at projecting what team, the way teams factor in the posting fee into their total expenditure relative to just what the player is getting. I think that when we're talking about like, you know, 15% of the total outlay for some of these players, that it's a bigger part of the team's calculus than we realize. And so I'm inclined to give Boras a win for this one because this guy's a Blue Jay and got very close to what we all expected to be market value, you know, having to deal with some of the political parts of the posting process. I'm inclined to slightly edge this one into the win column, although just purely based on the amount, it's more of a neutral draw.
Okay, I think, yeah, it's a little favorable, but I think you make some good points. I think we're probably going to be a little bit more critical on the EMI side, although this will be interesting. So I'm fine with it. And again, I think we'll give him a win, especially it's like, again, it's an awesome fit for him in a lot of respects. So getting that fourth year, who knows how much we ended up pushing beyond, how much was it the biggest offer, who knows? A soft win. Well, fine. Let's talk about EMI. Because what's so interesting about evaluating this contract is on one hand, you're like, well, that's so player friendly. You got opt-outs. You got opt-outs from Jim Crane. That's not something he's handing out very often, right? At the same time, this is why I cannot give this a win and probably am giving it a loss, but maybe could accept a draw. Listen, I know you're out there hyping your client. The fact that you were even putting him in the same sentence as Yamamoto, even as like a casual reference, to be like, oh, even if it was a bit of an exaggeration, oh, he's done what Yamamoto's done, is ludicrous and now looks particularly silly to pretend like he is even in the same hemisphere as Yamamoto, who, as we have made clear, and as have, you know, our friend Yuri has made clear, arguably the best pitcher that Japan has ever produced. At the time he was pitching, like what he was at the time, and obviously now what he's become. With that said, to end up with this shorter deal where like, sure, yeah, if he's awesome, he's going to maybe post and maybe get more money. We're saying if. I think that this is still, for how big of a game he was talking, I think that this is still an L. But what do you think?
I agree that it's an L.
Yeah.
I think if I'm going to play devil's advocate, well, the Yamamoto stuff is ridiculous. And at some point you're the, you know, rather than the boy who cried wolf, you're the agent who cried, you know, Yamamoto. When, how can we take anything you say? Why would I be influenced by anything you say when some of it is like this?
Yeah.
And so for like context, you know, when Yamamoto came over, I was like, you know, my grade on Yamamoto was commensurate with the best prospect in baseball at any given time. Like the comp was peak Zach Greinke, basically. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so there's some of that where you're discrediting yourself with some of the hyperbole. I do think that the opt-out pieces of this really protect Imai and work around some of the market dynamics that maybe were suppressing Imai's deal. The fact that it is a pitching-heavy free agent market, and when teams have alternatives left like Suarez and Valdez and
on the trade Zach Gallen,
correctamundo, yeah, that and the timeline, there's a deadline for this transaction to occur such that this is going to be one of the first dominoes to fall while there are all these other alternatives out there. It's going to suppress this guy's market. And so, you know, you're swimming upstream when that's the case. And when you have this opt out, you can just circumvent that, like just wait a year and you can hit free agency in a truer sense a year from now. And so I think there are pieces of this that, you know, you could argue make this more neutral, but generally I agree with you. This is way below what I thought the market for this guy was going to be, you know, based on the quality of his stuff and athleticism. And so I'm inclined to give Manel as well.
And the last point on that is, okay, great. Are you actually, I need to clarify this, but like, I'm pretty sure he could just get a qualifying offer next year, right? So like
I if guess he's awesome, so, yeah.
You're opting out into a lockout with a QO, like have fun. And also, by the way, you know what Scott Boras is going to be focused on next offseason? Derek Skubal. With that in mind, right. We are going to give Boras a win, another win here, because Tetsuya Imai showing up to the Texans game in all Boras apparel and all the picture, including the sweatpants, which really blew a lot of people's minds. It's one thing to wear this, the hoodie or the hat or the one that's just one piece. I mean, the full fit. With that picture being posted, not just on MLB social, but NFL accounts, like you're killing it. Like, come on. Like that's the whole, that's people are like Googling. What is it? What is this B that he's on? Yo, that's the guy sitting right next to him. Scott Boras. He's a big deal. B for big deal. That's
the Boras Court people. The amount of swag that they have. I don't.
Unbelievable.
It's yeah. Like you have, you know, your Herschel backpack with the B on there, or I think, Only old like Chappelle Show gear. Like I've seen, you know, like Neil Brennan wearing the like the zip up hoodie with like the C on the sleeve, and I'm just like, man, I really like there. I know there are only like 10 people. People like held a boom mic on those. Chappelle Show who have this gear.
Yeah.
That's the comp I'd make. Like in the sports world, the Boras gear is like that Chappelle Show C on like, you know, hoodies and stuff that you see some of the folks wearing, you know, on the old DVD commentaries and stuff. Just like,
incredibly good comparison. Like, but I will say Boras merch, as we know, because Jake has a hat, much more attainable. And I think still something that we can all aspire to because it is so funny. And also
we need Fangraphs merch like that.
Kind of, yeah. Right.
Like,
right.
We just need like Fangraphs, like varsity sweaters that only those of us who work for the site get.
Listen, the Boras Corporation, there we know that's a big operation, and presumably like there are people that are squarely thinking about merch most of the time, and I think that it is showing, and I think that they're doing a great job. With all that said, our Scobo update with two wins and a loss brings Mr. Boras to 12-4-10 on the season. We will see what our next Scobo update. Thank you, Eric, for that contribution to the Boras lore. We're going to take a break. When we return, you're going to hear my conversation with Chandler Rome of The Athletic talking about Imai and the Astros. Talk about the Astros. We'll be right back after Chandler with Eric and more Baseball Barbecue. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. I am now very excited to be joined by a special guest. He is the Astros beat writer for The Athletic. His name is Chandler Rome, and he hosts a podcast that I quite enjoy. Chandler, welcome to Baseball Barbacast, my friend.
I'm honored to be here. I'm sad this is my first time, but I'm honored to be here nonetheless.
So you mentioned it's your first time. It is a very important debut. The Astros certainly giving us enough news to talk about. Also, while Jake Mintz is on vacation, even more convenient. The podcast that you host, the Crush City Territory podcast, with you mentioned your first time on. The first time your co-host came on our podcast was like 10 years ago.
Told me, I think it was like to talk about Bo Porter. Like being a manager of the Astros, which is seems like forever ago.
Exactly. And so shouts out to Tyler Stafford, formerly Mr. Blogwell. If you know, you know. So I've certainly enjoyed your Astros coverage for quite some time. We make that reference to Bo Porter, and obviously we're not going to talk about that era of the Astros too much on this discussion about Tetsuya Imai, the newest member of the Houston Astros, but. I think that's actually weirdly a good place to start in terms of you've covered the Astros for quite some time. And it does sound like reading your work at The Athletic and listening to your pod with Tyler, that this move like legitimately shocked you. Like this was a move for someone that does follow the team very closely, that reports on the team very closely, that's one of the best in the biz at making sure that the fans know what the team is up to. This was not something that was really on your radar, certainly at the start of the offseason. So let's just start there, that they kind of established that this is, as far as the Astros have been in the news plenty, they've made a lot of interesting transactions over the years since you've been covering them. It is fair to say that this is pretty up there as far as a surprising transaction.
What's the Christmas vacation line? Like if I woke up with my head sewn to the ground, I wouldn't be more surprised than I am right now. That's kind of how I felt on New Year's Day when the agreement broke. I think it was, to be honest with you, and we'll get into this more, like they've just been so irrelevant in that market for so long. Like, look, they made the requisite attempt to try to sign Shohei Ohtani. They put together a package for him. There's a former Astros employee that still proudly tells me he's got a Shohei Ohtani Astros jersey in his closet based off of the presentation that they made for Ohtani. They courted Masahiro Tanaka way back when. But again, that was before they were in this era, before they were really, really carrying high payrolls and relevant. They've just been so absent in that market that it never dawned on really anyone to link them to Tetsuya Imai. And it wasn't just maybe the local beat. Like I read a lot of national coverage. I'm sure you guys talked about it here. And the Astros were never a team that you linked to Tetsuya Imai. But, you know, now given the benefit of hindsight and now given kind of what we know now and really what Tetsuya Imai had said in November about, you know, he didn't necessarily want to play alongside other Japanese players. He wanted that challenge of facing all these hurdles and obstacles that foreign players will face. He wanted that challenge of confronting them alone to see if he could handle it. And then he wanted to win. I think the Astros provide all of that. They've had very little Japanese presence here. They have no other Asian players on their team. So, yes, he will be very alone in confronting a lot of these hurdles head on. And then also, like, the Astros have been to the playoffs 8 of the past 9 years. They've they win a lot. And, you know, if not for so many injuries last year, you know, I think a lot of people forget they finished with the same record as the Detroit Tigers last year. And that was with Yordan Alvarez playing in 42 games. That was with them missing a ton of guys due to injury. Like, this team is still built. Maybe not a super team, but they're still built to win. They're still built to make a deep American League playoff run. So you put those two factors together, and it actually made a lot of sense. But yes, at the beginning when it happened, I was completely stunned.
I think that there's also some context that we can get into that you've written about, and that obviously at the press conference yesterday, you know, Jim Crane made very clear that sure you mentioned those past attempts, but there is also some important context. Recently, we can talk about Yusei Kikuchi and the success that he had, how that connects to Scott Boras's maybe affinity for considering Houston as a possibility for Imai. But also that, like, they have just spent more energy and effort and money scouting Asia and making sure that, like, this is not somewhere that is being ignored from a scouting perspective. You got to start somewhere, though, right? And they were you know, they're not the only team that has no very minimal, right? I mean, people joke it's just the Dodgers, but it really is a small collection of teams. When you look at the history of Japanese players coming over, it is a really a group of, you know, 5 to 8 teams that have, you know, made up the most of the signings, most of the major signings. Now, the Astros, in their case, were literally one of the handful that had never done it, that had actual zero from straight from NPB to MLB. But the thing that I'm really interested in with this outcome, because to you, as you mentioned, there are some parts of it will be like, well, wait a minute, duh, we knew the Astros were looking for starting pitching. And if this was what it was going to cost, which was certainly part of the big surprise as well, maybe this makes more sense. And we can get to that as well. It does seem like this is also not totally an accident that this player at this time, coming over after being arguably the best pitcher in NPB this past year, statistically, or one of, that Jim Crane was interested in pursuing a player in that market. That in that sense, it's not an accident, but it also sounds like the fact that his market was maybe less than we thought for a lot of people projected, that also helped this kind of come together.
Yeah, let's not get it twisted. Jim Crane yesterday at the news conference, you know, was very bullish about they want to move fast in Asia. They want to be laser focused on that market. And he promised that they will get more players from Asia and the Pacific Rim. But one thing that we know about him are very interesting to juxtapose to that. You know, one thing he said was like, you know, all that renewed energy and focus, like it probably didn't help here. Like this signing Tatsuya Imai is not in and of itself a reflection of the Astros' renewed energy and focus in expanding into Asia and the Pacific Rim. That was something that they really started in earnest like this past summer. And obviously, like Tatsuya Imai was far, far known and way down the road as a really good pitcher before then. So probably their renewed focus probably didn't help this signing specifically. But one thing Jim Crane said is it will help going forward. You know, I likened it in the story I wrote yesterday. I likened all of Monday to kind of a soft launch, right? It's a soft launch of their intentions to we're going to be more active in Asia and the Pacific Rim. Like we want to be there. Like this is us announcing to Japan and everybody over there. Like we want to be in that market. We want to be a player in that space. I'm just not sure that Imai himself and the contract he got was a direct reflection of that renewed focus. It'll just be like the starting point. The other thing is that Jim can say all he wants, that he wants to devote all these resources, and I believe him wholeheartedly. Like, he's one of those guys, when he says something, it's going to get done. But he ain't ever – I don't ever see him budging off of his aversion to the 8, 9, 10-year deals. This is an owner that has never given a free agent deal longer than 5 years. This is an owner that has never guaranteed any player in his ownership tenure more than $151 million. Be quite frank, if Tatsuya Imai's market developed as we all presumed it would, and he would have gotten the 8 or the 7-year deal that a lot of pundits were projecting, like the Astros would not have been players for him. Like it was a perfect confluence of a market not manifesting the way that Scott Boras thought it would, that the whole industry thought it would. It was an owner that set out this offseason to let it be known that they wanted a footprint in Asia and the Pacific Rim. And it was basically, they had a window. They had a posting window and the deadline was coming up. And for lack of a better phrase, it fell in their lap. It just all, there was a confluence of events that just kind of all fell in the Astros' lap and they couldn't pass it up.
Yeah. And it's a really interesting thing because it's more than just how this market developed, right? I think I do want to bring Kikuchi back into this conversation because, again, Scott Boras said his name within 3 seconds, you know, on the podium yesterday, right? And that's another thing where it's like, how do you, okay, maybe you haven't signed anyone in the past, but how do you make an impact on players? Now, in this case, it's also funny. It's like he happened to have another Boras client who's Japanese, right? But still, like, clearly that makes an impact. And if you think about the dynamics of the posting process and you think about a deadline being imposed and you think about, okay, what is going to get a deal done as a deadline is approaching? And if you're thinking about it from Scott Boras' standpoint, as that deadline is approaching and you know, he, by the way, I didn't realize how far back that relationship goes, right? He said he'd met Imai like 5 years ago. So I don't know if he's officially represented him in that capacity, but this is, they've been working towards this moment for a long time, right? That's why you hire Scott Boras. That's why you meet Scott Boras at any point, you know, as you're working towards this, literally this day, this decision. With the deadline, like you don't necessarily, you can't necessarily wait out there for, you know, there's a it's a kind of a wrench in the usual Boras bidding war process that we're maybe seeing with a Bregman right now or a Bellinger or whatever. And so that's where the relationships come into play. That's where the experience of Boras with his previous clients, that's where Boras's relationship with an owner all comes into play to help make a deal like this possible. Is that, would you say that's a, it went adding to the things that had the stars that needed to align to make this happen?
Yeah. Don't underestimate the sheer value that having Kikuchi here for those 2 months in 2024 played on this. You know, I talked about it when the agreement came into place, and then Scott basically said it on the podium on Monday. Like, and look, let's not like say that Yusei Kikuchi and Tatsuya Imai are identical, right? They throw with different hands, first of all. And then like their arsenals are a little different. Like it's not the exact same arsenal, but just the fact of Yusei came here, came to a place that we have talked about, like does not have a lot of Japanese people in the city, in the community. There's none in the clubhouse. And he came and had a great time. And
pitched got
very well. He got right. better. And that was the big thing too. And it feels like we've skirted around this, but like it's the Astros pitching infrastructure and the pitching and the way that they are able to get pitchers better.
Like, and if you're Scott Boras, what are we thinking about?
Scott Boras really thinking about? We got to opt out in 11 months and we got to go get this big deal. And that's why this whole thing is like, that's why this whole thing, like the soft launch thing has always kind of been in my head. It's just like, because if everything goes according to how the Astros want it to go, this is a 10-month pairing with Imai and the Astros. Because as we said, Jim Crane ain't given him 7-8 years if he opts out for $100 or $200 million. Like, but what it can do is it can announce to the world that they are active in that market. And it can help the 2026 Astros, because this is a team that needs some sort of stability behind Hunter Brown in their rotation. I'm still unsure what we're going to see from Imai, but he certainly has the upside to be a solid number three, maybe low-end number two starter in a rotation. And the Astros, that is exactly what they need. That's what this rotation needs. So, but yeah, like to hear Scott say, like, again, like I think his first sentence on the podium yesterday was, we had a great experience with Kikuchi coming here, and they were able to tell Tatsuya Imai that. They were able to, you know, and they were able to communicate that to him. But also, let's remember, like, when Yusei Kikuchi came to the Astros, he had been in Major League Baseball for 5 years. Like, the thing I'm going to be fascinated to see is, like, this is an organization entirely that has never had to work with a pitcher through his transition from NPB. Like, this is uncharted territory for Joe Espada, for pitching coach Josh Miller, for Dana Brown. Like, they've never had this. And, you know, Joe said yesterday that he wants to call a couple of players that he knows that have played in NPB. He wants to call a couple managers that have had pitchers straight from NPB. Should be noted that he and Carlos Mendoza are very close. I'd imagine they're going to talk about how Mendoza handled Kodai Senga in his first couple years in the big leagues. Maybe he calls Dave Roberts. I'm not sure. But that is probably the next most fascinating thing, is kind of how this organization that has never had to deal with and confront and help a pitcher coming straight from a foreign league, how they're able to help him kind of assimilate on the, you know, on the job, you know, as the season starts. That'll be a fascinating thing to watch.
The last thing I want to kind of hit on with, again, like, how does this happen? Why does Jim Crane want this to be, you know, the start of something? And then I do want to get to just some bigger picture questions about like the Astros of 2026, because there's still a lot of just like, where do they go from here? Because yes, they've certainly addressed the pitching staff, but that does not mean this offseason is over for them. But again, I do think that there's still some elements of the contract, right? When you discuss, okay, is this good for Imai? Is this good for the team? Well, first of all, as we'll get into, like the Astros, you could say, well, what's the upside for the Astros? If he's good, he's going to leave. Well, the Astros are trying to win right now. And so if Imai's good, that's all you're going to be thinking about this summer. And if he's somewhere in the middle and he sticks around, then you're, it's just something that you have moving forward. And if not, if he's not good, like that becomes a different conversation and we'll find out. And there is something interesting to me about him being like, clearly gives the upside, but also a huge unknown. Right. Well, you don't really know what you're what you're getting with this guy, as evidenced by the industry's maybe collective hesitance to commit to him super long term. There are going to be some questions that he's going to have to answer. I think Houston's in a good position to prove that they can do that. But back to Crane, right? Because let's also mention, I don't think you mentioned it earlier, what's the name of the ballpark now, right?
Well,
you know, give some context there too about Daikin.
Did you watch the entire news conference yesterday?
I believe so. Yeah.
Did you catch Jim Crane like out of nowhere introducing the Daikin chief marketing officer two minutes in, like before Tatsuya Imai had even spoken, before they put a jersey on him at all? It was, let's introduce Daikin's chief marketing officer who's sitting in the front row. I can't overstate how much getting that naming rights deal done has accelerated the Astros' advancement in the Asian and Pacific Rim. For those that are unaware, Daikin is an HVAC company that is based in Osaka, Japan. They renamed the ballpark. It actually went into effect around this time last year, so January of 2025. But then, like that July, Jim Crane and a contingent of Astros employees went to visit Daikin headquarters in Japan, just to, I guess, as a sign of trust, as a sign of, you know, just a good faith meeting. Just the deal was done and everything, but they went as kind of a final cherry on top. And Jim said that trip, when they took him around the country, and Jim, like, for those that don't know about Jim Crane, he's a logistics magnate. That's how he made all his money. He owns a worldwide freight company. He does have an office in Tokyo, so it's not as if he was foreign to or didn't know about the market, but it really opened his eyes. He said when he went to Japan, the Daikin people kind of took them around the country. He got to see all the baseball stadiums, and that's when it dawned on him that they're not doing enough in Asia. And so you can directly tie it back to, they had to go there to see the Daikin people. Like, Daikin is the new name of the ballpark. Again, I'm not sure Tatsuya Imai particularly cares that he's sure playing in a ballpark that has the Japanese name on it. But it's just more evidence that this is real, that the Astros, this is not just lip service. This is not just they got a Japanese guy and they want to like put on a show for Monday to say that we're invested. No, this is something that has been in the works for a while, and it's something that will advance beyond this signing.
And I know it may sound crazy and it just sounds like I'm making this up, but I remember watching the Daikin intro press conference a year ago. I know it's like, Jordan, what a loser. I can't believe you tuned into that. And I don't know if you were there for that, Chandler, where they did the whole intro. But I remember thinking, I was like, of all the teams to suddenly have a Japanese, you know, company naming their ballpark, it's one of the four teams that had never signed a player from NPB, right? And so I guess that was, you know, a year that was right after Kikuchi had been there, right? But obviously it's a little bit of a different circumstance. But it is now, here we are sitting here, and it's clearly a relevant factor, and it's hard not to think back to that and think that it is a relevant piece of data. So, okay, so Imai, like, we could talk about him. And by the way, like, what a start to his Houston experience. We got the Texans game. We got him literally standing right behind Kevin Durant for a game winner last night, which was incredible. So he's living it up. Like, he's embracing it. You kind of talked about how he's been open. Like, I want to embrace the challenge of transitioning to a new country, to a new community. And he's certainly not hesitating to do so, which is all good. But I do want to talk about the baseball team now, right? Because, all right, Tatsuya Imai, he's going to be good. He's going to be bad. We're going to see. There's a lot of other things that are going to impact whether the Astros are good or bad this season. And I think that we do have the big one that I just want to hit, but before I let you go here, is just this glut of infielders. Or infielders is really not the word to use, but hitters,
DHs.
Right? Hitters,
DHs.
DHs, right? DHs. Now, some of them are DH, by definition of like they suck at defense. Some of them are DH by where else are they going to hit? Where else are they going to play? And so let's talk about these players, right? We're really talking about four guys for essentially two spots, arguably, which is Yordan Alvarez, Jose Altuve, who are essentially the faces of the franchise, right? Those are the guys that have defined in a lot of ways this era of Astros baseball over the last, you know, half decade. Christian Walker, who entering year two of a free agent deal that hilariously, right after they signed an identical one with Jose Abreu, is looking eerily similar. Not that bad, but, you know, concerning. And then Isak Paredes, who they acquired for Kyle Tucker and when was on the field was very good, but then also had a lot of injuries. And the timing of that injury is coinciding with Carlos Correa's inexplicable return. has resulted in Isak Paredes not having a position to play, essentially, even though he is still, by all accounts, quite a good hitter. Altuve and Yordan Alvarez are relevant because the way that the manager, Joe Espada, has spoken about them, he does not seem to really want either of them to be playing a whole lot of defense. Certainly Alvarez. Altuve, I would love some more clarification from you. So as we sit here now in early January, this is not a functional roster group. I think that is fair to say. So you don't necessarily have to predict what's going to happen, but how did we get here? And what is maybe the most likely path forward for this group?
Well, we got here because Isak Paredes basically tore his hamstring off the bone while running down the line in Seattle last July. Sustained a severe hamstring strain that, at the time, the Astros thought was going to keep him out for the whole season. So they needed a third baseman. Like, they went into the trade deadline last year. They were fighting with the Mariners for supremacy in the AL West. They had a playoff spot at that point secured. They needed a third baseman. The Minnesota Twins were doing what they do. And, you know, it was a Jim Crane special at the trade deadline because as he talked about yesterday, you know, when he talked about the luxury tax yesterday, you know, just basically said, get me to the deadline. And then, like, you've seen what we do at the deadline. Right.
I'll do something.
And here we are. So they needed a third baseman. They went and got Carlos Correa to play third base. And at the time, there were people, me, questioning, like, all right, like, I get the fit in 2025. Like, it's obvious. Like, the 2025 Astros needed a third baseman. The Astros went and got the best third baseman out there available at that point to play.
Who they happen to have an intimate knowledge of.
Correct. But everyone could see from a mile away that, like, this isn't going to work in 2026 because Isak Paredes was going to be healthy and going to be ready to contribute in 2026. They have Jeremy Peña at shortstop. And, you know, Carlos Correa, from the minute he started playing third base for the Astros, said, I love it. It keeps me healthier. It keeps me fresher. I feel better. Like, I'm never moving back to shortstop. So that's never happening. You've got – and so that's how we got to the logjam, right? We got reacquiring Correa is the thing that has put them into this position.
Well, so, and we should just say – and the large contract that Correa is still on that seemingly entrenches him at third base next to Peña for the foreseeable future.
Sure, but even if it was a less cumbersome contract, like, I don't think it's one of those things where they would, like, dump Correa. Because, like, he means too much to the city. He means too much. Right. Like, they got him back, and it was like, he's retiring here. Like, he's never.
Yes. No, I for sure. I get it. But it's like, okay, well, there's your left side of the infield. So now what?
So as the offseason began, that became the primary question is, like, how do you fit these five dudes into four spots? And so at the winter meetings, we got some clarity. You know, Joe Espada, you kind of alluded to it. Joe Espada said he wanted Yordan Alvarez. He made no uncertain terms. Yordan Alvarez is going to be the primary DH. He's going to spend most of his time at designated hitter. I think their foremost goal is to, like, the foremost goal in all of this and everything we're about to talk about is they've got to keep Yordan Alvarez on the field. He played 48 games last year.
Right.
If he plays 58 games last year, they probably make the playoffs. And then who knows what happens after that. But they've got to keep him on the field. What's interesting is that none of his injuries recently have come from playing defense. Like he had a chronic hand thing. And then when he had the freak ankle injury at the end of the season, that was him like stepping on home plate awkwardly while scoring from second base. Like none of his injuries in the past two or three years have had to do anything with defense, but still they want to keep him. They want to like avoid that thought at any point. So
sure.
They want him to DH. I think as is well known now, Jose Altuve made the move to left field for parts of last season. Injuries forced him to play more second base than I think they wanted to before the season. But at the winter meetings, Joe Espada strongly hinted, without just outright saying it, that they would like second base to be Altuve's primary position in 26. That's not to say he won't play some left field. That's not to say Yordan Alvarez won't play some left field. But they would like, I think their most ideal configuration is Alvarez DHing and Altuve at second base, which makes it impossible for both Isak Paredes and Christian Walker to get any semblance of everyday at-bats. The only way this was going to work was if the DH spot was truly open and truly free to maneuver guys around. You could DH Walker one day, let Paredes play first, Altuve at second, Yordan in left, and you're good. Like, but everything we have heard to this point suggests that that's not going to be the case, that they will not have the DH to free up. There is no one in baseball that thinks Isak Paredes can handle second base at any sort of an everyday level. That's not to say Jose Altuve does a great job of it either, but at least there is like the track record of he can play the position. There's a lot of people that don't think Isak Paredes can do that. So now they're left with, well, what do you do? Isak Paredes is more valuable to the 2026 Astros than Christian Walker. Like he, at times last year, was their best hitter. He is the only guy in the lineup that sees pitches. He's the only guy in the lineup that has an on-base percentage to the point where he works walks. To like Yordan works walks because pitchers are afraid of him. Like Paredes works walks because he's just really, really disciplined. He's got great plate discipline and approach. The problem is, I don't know that you're trading Christian Walker. I don't know that you're going to convince a team to take on Christian Walker with $40 million and 2 years left on it. The Astros are going to have to pay some of that down if they trade him. Christian Walker has a limited no trade clause. He can block trades to six teams. Not sure what those teams are. But it leaves them in a fascinating little crossroads. You know, Dana Brown, the whole offseason has expressed, oh, like we're fine with it. We're fine with the surplus. We got to get guys off their feet anyway. But I mean, as I keep saying, like anyone that will listen, like if you have been in a major league clubhouse for at any length of time, like you go try telling Isak Paredes in his third year of ARB that, hey, you're only going to get 400 at bats this year. And that too, like all these fans, like every, and I got into a reply fest with some of them the other day.
I enjoyed reading those.
all these fans have like, every time I bring up that like, hey, like they're probably gonna have to trade Isak Paredes. And they're like, oh, you can't, he's untouchable. And I ask, okay, well, how's he gonna play? And they give me all these permutations. Like, oh, he can play this many games here. And it's like, guys, like in no way are you, anything you're giving me suggests he's going to be an everyday player. So how can you say he is that important to the Astros when he is? Don't get me wrong. Very important. How can you say that when you're also going to bring him back in a non-regular role? That makes no sense. So it's my like strong opinion and my kind of just informed thought that the Astros are going to have to make a call. They're going to have to like within the next 3 or 4 weeks before they get to camp, one of Isak Paredes or Christian Walker is probably going to have to go for no other reason than they need more practical roster construction. They need to be able to get these guys every day at bats. And also like, Yordan Alvarez is making almost $30 million this year. Jose Altuve is making $30 million this year. Isak Paredes is going to make $10 million in ARB. And Christian Walker is going to make $20 million. That's a lot of money tied into. And even when you distill it down to Paredes and Walker, like that's almost $30 million tied up in two guys that you right now can't guarantee every day at bats. That's not practical financial allocation of resources either. So they've got to figure this out. I don't envy Dana Brown because it's going to be difficult. But if we're talking like purely like what would they get the most value back on, like what would be the better trade for them, it's Isak Paredes. But as we've talked about with Tatsuya Imai, they are a win now 2026 team, and trading Isak Paredes makes that more difficult in 2026.
It makes it more difficult, but it is also not hard to see, and we can wrap here, but there are a lot of questions in the outfield too. I mean, my goodness, do you like not really know what you have going on in the outfield? And so you would say, well, what would you trade Isak Paredes for? Well, you could trade him for more pitching, because while you have pointed out, yes, maybe they do have too many starters now, although does that really exist? Nope. There's also some huge questions still in the outfield with how bad Jesus Sanchez was, with what Cam Smith was as a rookie in the second half. With, again, if Jordan's not going to play the outfield and Altuve's not going to play the outfield, well, then who's in left field, right? Is Jake Meyers getting traded? There's so many things that can still happen with this Astros offseason. And as with every Astros move, what makes them so interesting is, you know, Jim Crane's clearly pushing a lot of buttons. And so with respect to Dana Brown and his credentials and whatever moves he has or has not been directly involved in making, we will see how Crane plus Brown plus Espada choose to maneuver this roster moving forward. But Chandler Rome, this has been a pleasure. I'm sorry we did not get to talk about Nate Pearson and, you know, my man Rodery Munoz, which, believe it or not, I do have Rodery Munoz opinions, but I'll save them for another day. Chandler, where can people check out your work? And then we'll let you say get out of here.
On X at Chandler_Rome. I need to look at my blue sky. I post on Blue Sky. I just don't remember the handle. Oh, it's Chandler Rome with no spaces .bsky.social. I'm on there. Mm-hmm. And the Crush City Territory podcast with Tyler Stafford. Crush City Pod. Tune into that. But yeah, basically everywhere. Yeah. Trying to just keep up.
Chandler, don't worry, guys. Normally, he is not shocked by what the Astros are doing. But well, with all that said, thank you for the time. We appreciate it. And we'll get you on again soon. Thanks.
All right. Yeah, thanks. This was fun.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Thanks again to Chandler Rome for joining me to talk about Imai and the Astros. Welcome back, Eric Longenhagen. Thanks for being here as a guest co-host. I greatly appreciate it. We are going to now talk about something that is obviously way larger than anything within the scope of this podcast or anything that we do on a daily basis covering baseball. But it is related. And that is, of course, what is happening in Venezuela and what has occurred over the weekend involving the removal of President Nicolas Maduro. This is something that is so much bigger than baseball, obviously, and the implications are far more important than anything we're about to talk about. However, it would also be disingenuous to pretend like this is not relevant to some of the things that we cover. So, Eric, I know there are parts of this that are very challenging to talk about, and we're going to do our best to kind of cover it responsibly and respectfully, and to keep it within the confines of what we feel comfortable talking about. But it is something that impacts our sport and impacts our league and impacts the people that exist in our sport. This is obviously, Venezuela has, of course, a big part of the player population, but it's more than that. There's a lot of elements to this that are both interesting and harrowing and concerning. And the reality is, I think we're going to ask more questions than really anything in this conversation, but it's something that I think we wanted to have space to do. So, I'll throw it to you. I think that, you know, the timing here in terms of a really pressing thing is there's many elements to this. There's a lot of different layers that we can get into. One of the ones that's a little bit lower down, but I know is something that you're working on, and part of why you've been having a lot of conversations about this is that January 15th is the international signing period opening, right? So the amateurs from predominantly, you know, Latin America, whether it's Dominican, of course, Venezuela, are going to be signing their first pro contracts in January. And so because of that, Eric, who covers prospects, has been on the phone and texting with a lot of people who are involved in the international space. We know that it's a lot bigger than that. We can get into that. But I know you've had some conversations with some folks around the game, just trying to kind of wrap your head around where this might be going and how Venezuela has been impacted and what it means right now for baseball in that country.
Yeah, even around winter meetings, just talking with folks who deal either in the international space or just like my friends who have to do logistical travel stuff for the orgs they work for, there was already smoke and anticipation among some of my sources that this was a volatile situation, that they might have to extract their young employees from Venezuela in a rushed, potentially harrowing fashion, depending on how things transpired with, you know, our government and theirs. And so there were some teams who anticipated this and were already dealing with a lot of the red tape that goes into immigration and, you know, work visas and how to, you know, just the logistics of getting Venezuelan players from there to the United States, or, you know, in the case of the kids who are going to sign in like a week and a half, to the Dominican Republic. And this has been an issue independent of all of, you know, our recent events. It's already been a challenging thing a lot of the time. I mean, you know, I spoke with a person who, they had a player whose father was a janitor at like a school that is like a public school run by the government, and therefore he was declared an employee of the Venezuelan government, and the player was struggling to get clearance to travel to the United States because his janitor father worked for the Venezuelan government. And so like it's been stuff like that for a while, to the point where you know, Venezuelan players often showcased in Colombia as a result of like how difficult it is to get personnel from the United States in and out of Venezuela. And, you know, scouting directors held that at knife and gunpoint, being mugged, like some of this stuff has gone on over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years. In this case, you know, some of the folks I've talked to the last couple of days feel more or less prepared than others. There are, you know, people who work in international scouting who have told me that they're hoping Major League Baseball directs them as, you know, to what to do, or can step in somehow to help remove some of the players from harm's way if they happen to be in it. There are some teams who feel very prepared and who have players who are going to sign for a lot of money in a week and a half already in the Dominican Republic. And in the past, some players have already been in Arizona or Florida, you know, at their team's complex to do this sort of thing. And then I spoke to someone, well, I didn't speak to them because they were just like, hey, I'm absolutely slammed trying to work on this and figure this out. I don't even have time to talk to you about what it is I'm going through. So, you know, it runs the gamut right now how prepared any given team is for this. And I think the fact that it seems to be on each individual team at this moment to try to maneuver and navigate the situation is potentially concerning. And we have, you know, big leaguers playing Venezuelan Winter League games, you know, and such as well. So, you know, it is a high profile thing that, you know, I think it's a dire situation potentially that everyone wants to try to handle as quickly as possible.
And that's the thing, is it's hard not to just kind of keep zooming out and understanding the different parties that are being impacted. But as you just referenced, the state of affairs has already changed pretty drastically over the past decade. You know, you mentioned the players who are going to sign, likely going to the Dominican Republic to sign at those academies. The concept of like having academies down there for these really young players to prepare to start their professional careers, every team has one of those in the Dominican Republic. That is 30 for 30 down there, is certainly my understanding. 10 years ago, there was a more consistent presence across the league in Venezuela. There used to be, in the way that there is now, only a Dominican summer league of these players that play before they come stateside. There used to be a Venezuelan summer league. That has not existed since 2015. When you go back and look at it, even the years that league was in existence, which was really only for about 10 years in that kind of structure, not even every team was down there. I mean, it was really only half the league that even had a presence down there consistently. By the end of that league in 2015, there were only 5 teams that were represented: the Mariners, Cubs, Phillies, Tigers, and Rays. So as you mentioned, there's already been kind of this gradual exodus in terms of a permanent presence, because the reality is it's just not safe. But that hasn't stopped a lot of really promising and important Venezuelan players from signing, making it to the big leagues, becoming superstars, becoming faces of our sport, whether that's an Altuve, whether that's an Acuna, whether that's the Contreras brothers. You know, like, these are players that are really important and really relevant for a lot of reasons, not to mention, you know, the Miguel Cabreras of the world, right? Like, this is a such an important country and place in baseball history, including the current moment. And so you mentioned the Venezuelan Winter League. That's a league that is, of course, going on in Venezuela right now. They paused the games for a few days because of what's going on. They are expected to resume play tomorrow, I believe, on Wednesday, which is, I know, maybe difficult for some people to fathom. But you can also understand that in some respects, they're trying to keep things going along as normal as much as they can. There's also some interesting what ifs involving the teams that are still playing, because they are in the round robin playoff round of that league, and the teams that are based in Caracas, which is, you know, currently the place that is considered the most dangerous and is really for those on a day-to-day basis right now, those teams based in Caracas just happened to be eliminated before this round robin started. So, you know, how likely would it have been if they were able to resume this league? At the same time, it's already had ramifications. You know, normally when the Winter League concludes, there's a Caribbean series where the champions of all of the winter leagues in Dominican and Venezuela and Mexico, they come together for a tournament and they play in the beginning of February. That tournament was supposed to be in Venezuela this year. And the other nations were like, we're not doing that. We're not participating. And so they moved it around and now it's going to take place in Mexico. But my understanding is that the Venezuelan league has decided, like, we're not sending anybody, like, you can't go to this other league that took the tournament out of our country. So there's so many competing, complicated, challenging, dangerous factors involved. And then, of course, there's the WBC, right, which is, of course, something that we're thinking about. I think that's a slightly different conversation because of the stakeholders involved. But the reality is we're talking about the safety of players that are people, of course, first and foremost. As we just said, all of this is way bigger than baseball. But within the scope of this podcast and just covering the sport, this is a very relevant thing that is unfortunately not going to necessarily change. I mean, we know it's going to change in some respect, but this is about as fluid as it gets. And, you know, even if we were geopolitical experts, I'm not really sure we'd be able to speak in any sort of definitive terms, because it is just such a scary and hour-to-hour situation.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I've been, you know, it'll be 10 years for me at Fangraphs in June, and you just never know what kind of strange happenings across the globe are going to force you to learn and adjust and sort of rise to the occasion when it comes to, like, covering and talking about some of this stuff. Just, you know, the hubris of our comfort a lot of the time, even as, you know, different things have impacted. If you cover, I don't know, hockey, well, stuff with Russia and Ukraine has probably impacted the way you talk about, you know, world junior championships or whatever it is. And now here it is, you know, coming for baseball. And I just, you know, can't imagine, first and foremost, like, what the dynamic of Venezuelan players in a locker room who do or don't disagree with, you know, what's it like. It's just such a complex thing that we're all about to, I think, navigate.
And as always, I would just encourage people to listen to folks that understand this more than you maybe think you do or want to. And there's a lot of loud people right now online in a lot of spaces. So, again, we're going to do our best. Obviously, it's not a fun topic, but it's important, and we will cover it in the way that it's relevant to our sport, because it undeniably is right now. So, thank you, Eric, for helping give some perspective and insight on that. And obviously we welcome any perspective. We're always trying to cover these things as responsibly and respectfully as we can. With all that said, there was one other topic that I did want to hit with you, Eric, that's more up your alley, and I think a little bit more fun to talk about, although it is a little bit more in the disappointing realm. And it's just prospects are doing your job as hard. Right. Not just when you're forced to talk about politics, but when you're trying to say, hey, this baseball player is going to be good. I'm going to write a list and I'm going to say these players, this is the order of them in how good they are. Yeah, I that's what I do. And I'm going to be so right and so wrong all the time when you're putting out as much work as you are, Eric. And I use that as a preamble to say that Jared Kelnick has signed a minor league deal with the Chicago White Sox. And with that as my opening statement and transaction that we are going to finish this podcast on, I just thought that this would be an interesting lens for you to kind of talk about the process. And you could talk about Kelnick specifically, but his trajectory as a this is one of the guys, like, he will change a franchise, he is all these things, to now where he is, coming off a season where he had like a 500 OPS in AAA, is I imagine a trajectory among many that forces you to just constantly try and be better, but also throw your hands up and say this is hard. So what do you, when I say Jared Kelnick signed a minor league deal with the White Sox, what comes to mind?
Well, yeah, you do. It's you got to strike a balance, right? Because there's not really any accountability for me or people in, who do what I do for a living. Like the half dozen of us or so who are tasked with like doing what I do with the scope at which I do it. And there are just challenges inherent in it. Like I'm a person who can be dumb and wrong, and Jared Kelnick's a person who can be dumb and flawed and lift too many weights in the way he did and lose some of the baseball, the athleticism that he had as a 19-year-old, or maybe the coaches who have, you know, touched and tried to develop him, they're flawed people who make mistakes too, and on and on and on, right? And so there's just some, human error is just a part of this process, a part of my process inherently. And it's thousands of times every calendar year, right? With each individual player. And so you have to forgive yourself for being overzealous about Christian Pache and, you know, Jared Kelnick and Yadier Alvarez and being too light on Matt Olson, who wasn't on a single publication's top 100 prospect lists his final year in the minor leagues, and, you know, Matt Chapman, who was more like towards the back of mine rather than, you know, stuffed in the top 10 like he should have been in a, you know, perfect world projection. So it feels bad. I mean, you know, you try to ascertain what it is about Jared Kelnick that has made him mediocre to bad during the arc of his career as a big leaguer. Kelnick was known as a good high school prospect from an early age, in part because he was older than most of the rest of the kids in his high school graduating classes. So that brings me to thing number one is, hey, remember most of these guys who are 19 on draft day don't really pan out. There are exceptions for sure, but generally when you are more physically mature than your peers in high school and are dominating them in part for that reason, they are going to catch up to you. You know, we should look at your data with a grain of salt. We should look at your performance with a grain of salt when you are a full year older than some of these other guys, sometimes a year and a half, 2 years older than the ones who are on the younger end of the spectrum, the 17-year-olds graduating high school that year. And that's a real relevant data point that should contextualize our thoughts on that player. Physical maturity, a year's worth of physical development and skill development when you're in high school is a big, big deal. And so that's part of it. And then, you know, Jared Kelnick, when we're talking about, when we look at the baseball athletes who are special, who become Mike Trout, who become, you know, Vladdy Guerrero, who become Shohei Ohtani, and, you know, even the flawed ones like Elly De La Cruz and O'Neill Cruz and some of these players who frustrate us, they're freaks. They're like Aaron Judge was striking out a lot in Fresno. He's a freak. Maybe we should listen to that. Jared Kelnick was never in that stratosphere. Jared Kelnick was always, even at his best, was, hey, this guy's pretty good at everything. And he never had that freak factor.
Right.
That I think
now I've... Which
made him
feel safer. That's what's so wild about it, right? Is it like it gave you a level of comfort where it's like when you were comparing him and Julio, it was like, well, clearly if it works with Julio, it's going to be way better. But like, I don't know because he's younger and there's all these other trend lines. Whereas Kelnick, it's like we have only seen him be good every year since he was 14. Why would he suddenly start being bad? Well, there's maybe a lot of reasons that went into that. But
sometimes so many of these players like – and. You really see it more in college baseball.
Yep.
The arc of the athleticism of some of these players peaks at age 20, 21, and then starts
to
dip. And when you sign out of high school, that arc can occur when you're in professional baseball rather than when you're at Auburn or Clemson, you know? So there's so many. Think about like Tommy White. Think about Caden Grice. Think about some of these players who have stellar freshman years, and then by the time they're juniors, we're just like, hey, like, this is kind of the same deal? Or maybe even worse because that's just how some of these athletes trend. You peak at some of us, you know, myself included, you know, peak as athletes when we're 20, 21, when I can like run a 5K in, you know, 22 minutes or whatever it is. And maybe it was even better than that, but I was punished for it. But you know, it's just not. And then Ellie, guys like Ellie and, you know, Shohei and Judge, their athletic longevity is just at a different level. And they continue to refine their skills as they enter their mid to late 20s. And this is what we get.
Yeah. And maybe, listen, maybe there is a more positive chapter here where Kelnick can rebound, right? I mean, boy, did Joe Adell get a lot of chances before he finally figured something out. You know, still at a 290 on base, but 37 homers is
freak factor, though.
Freak factor, sure, right. And not everyone's getting the runway that Joe Adell's getting in Anaheim. I mean, let's be honest, too. I mean, there's a lot of situational things that help there. But I hope, listen, I would love to see Kelnick find his way back into some sort of major league role. I think what he showed in 23 says that maybe that is possible. But it is just such a reminder of what makes your job and someone like me who's always passionate about this space forever fascinated and, you know, frustrated. And I think it's the way
their personhood too. Like if we're comparing and contrasting those two guys, especially Kelnick, when Kelnick would fail there, and this is, you know, totally feel free to call BS on any of this. This is absolutely in, you know, subjective psychoanalyzing, like way different than looking at.
I think everyone was seeing this, so it's okay. Yeah.
Jared Kelnick would fail and there would be anger and frustration. Joe Adell seems more like an introspective, thoughtful, like not necessarily like sunny, happy, but definitely the way failure washed over Joe Adell was much different than Jared Kelnick. The way Adell has talked about his own, you know, even some of the meta stuff, you know, related to the way we as an industry wrote about Joe Adell. Although, like, what do you want me to say when you're dropping a fly ball, you know, a can of corn fly ball? Like, you want me to say you're a totally polished defensive outfielder? Like, you're not, but
well, and as we know,
learning about these guys, I think there's something about Joe Adell's personhood that has facilitated long-term growth.
100%. But as we know about athletes, right? They're like, oh man, the haters. It's like, well, I was just writing what I was watching. Like, you were bad and now you're good. That's awesome. That's great. We would love for all these guys. Sorry. We're just saying what we're seeing, and then maybe you'll overcome it. Maybe you won't. That's the nature of the beast. All right, Eric. We've gone long enough. This was a treat. Thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. I hope you had a reasonably good time.
I did, buddy. I love you guys so much and think, you know, so highly of the operation that you guys have here at Yahoo. You know, you and Jake and obviously like the whole crew. So thank you so much for having me. Hope we get to do it again when some of the data and video sharing stuff becomes a little clearer. It was one of the topics that we wanted to hit on today that we just didn't have time, but future weeks and months.
I think we can bring Eric back on for that at some point this season, but thank you for filling in. I really appreciate it. I know Jake appreciates it too. And I'm just going to keep this very simple. Folks, support Fangraphs. I don't know how anyone as a baseball fan functions without it. Get a membership, support Fangraphs. It's as good as it gets. Eric's a huge part of what makes their coverage incredible. And it's one of the most important resources we have as baseball humans on this earth. And I just want to make sure. So I'll do that. I'll do that. Make sure that that's clear. Thank you, Eric. Thank you to producer Andrew Hartz, Ingrid Rosas for making this show possible. Thank you to Chandler Rome for joining me. You can email us baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. I'll be back with another special guest or two. We will see on Friday. But until then, everyone have a nice week. Talk to you soon. Goodbye.